Currently living in Wollongong, Ali Khalifa is an innovator of global stature, focused on social impact and sustainability. Ali is driven by harvesting plastic waste from our oceans to turn it into something useful as part of a circular economy. His training as both a designer and mechanical engineer, coupled with deep international manufacturing experience, has enabled him and his team to launch products for some of the most recognised consumer brands on the globe. His work has been celebrated internationally. He's an Eisenhower Fellow who has garnered more than 24 patents. Ali's also working closely with Mia Mays and the team at the Bega Valley Innovation Hub. Please welcome Ali Khalifa. People with arms keep their own style.
Wow, thank you so much. You might pick up the American accent. I apologize. I'll probably use some improper language. So I've been in Wollongong for about 9 months. My kids, who are in elementary school, already correct me all the time about that. And it's an unintended consequence of being here. As a father of two young ones, there's unintended consequences that are happening around the house all the time. You know, when I was climbing on that, I didn't mean for it to fall down and break, you know. And unintended consequences is something we live with as humans. It's something that we are constantly dealing with. We try to solve one problem, and we might create one or two more in so doing. And in thinking about the work that I've been doing in ocean plastic and trying to figure out how to deal with the marine debris, I have to just say that's what it is. This is some unintended consequences that we're dealing with. And once again, I think humans are good at, you know, making more problems that more humans are going to have to solve. It's a good, you know, it's a constant work program if we keep this up, you know. But I'd like to just maybe just reflect a little bit about that and tell you at least about some of my just own personal experiences with it. Great. So one of my brothers, Kareem, was in Honduras in the Peace Corps, so it's kind of like a public work program, and my brother and his soon-to-be wife were volunteering there, and I spent some time. I just had a great time. I took a month just to live in rural parts of Honduras, and I remember spending some time with a farming village. I think it was 7 homes. And we were, I was allowed to help with the farm. And the kids there had so much fun with me about, like, how I didn't know how to milk a cow, you know, how my hands blistered unbelievably, like epically blistered from machete work. And all of it they just thought was the funniest thing. And after all that was done, after a full day's work was done, then it was time to take the homemade soccer ball and then play a full soccer match after that. And you can imagine working in the sun and the steam and the heat and all that, and you're so thirsty. Here. And to realize that this is the everyday, right? This is the everyday situation of what this family grows up with. I mean, they put this on the table proud, right? Like, this is what we do. Here, you're part of us. Here you go. I don't know if I'm really that thirsty. I'm not really sure. But then I got to meet Mr. Amoeba after that. So I was happy, you know, no visa required. You can just come colonize my stomach for a while. And you know, I don't know if any of you ever had amoebas in your stomach. It's an unforgettable experience. In Honduras at the time, the only way to get rid of amoebas was to take arsenic. So you want to take it for long enough, but not too long. So wow, you know, that's a lot of learning right there. Additionally, while I was there, a boiler blew up, and this boiler was the maker. Is where they're making this local soda called Copan Dry. Awesome soda. You could not put one more grain of sugar into this thing without the thing solidifying. You know, it's just unbelievable. But it was clean water. It was boiled, you know, and Mr. Amoeba was not hanging out there. However, Copan Dry was a threat to some other American companies that were selling their sweet drinks there. And it's really interesting because when you went to like a little bodega to buy a Copan Dry, the glass is pretty valuable. So this is what you'd get. So they would pour the bottle into a little plastic bag, put a plastic straw in it, and everyone's walking around town. That's how you did it, because a lot of shopkeepers said the glass is way too valuable. It was around like, you know, maybe around the equivalent of about 10 US cents or something like that was the deposit on it. But actually, they were more valuable than 10 cents. In fact, when you really went to it and you did the economics, the value of the bottle was more than the value of the contents that were in it. So when these other friends from America decided that they wanted to compete and they couldn't crack the market of Copan Dry because it's really built to their flavor profile, not colas and stuff like that, well, the easiest thing to do was for them to buy a bunch of Copan Dry to pay for that deposit and then break all their bottles. Then Copan Dry could no longer afford to be in business. So it's kind of interesting. At the same time, while my brother was working in Honduras, then a lot of it was working on water systems, how to bring clean water to villages. And in that was just an amazing amount of infant mortality. So every single person I met had a sibling that had died of some form of dysentery, some type of, whether it's amoebas or something like that. There was just an incredible amount of people. You didn't know one person who didn't have a sibling who died from a lack of clean water. So what a huge change when you have all of a sudden some clean water systems come in, and there's clearly a need, right? There's a problem here that we can solve. So, you know, where is Honduras now, right? These are some kind of interesting things. For one, the infant mortality has fallen way lower. There's a lot more access to clean water. The death of children before five is much reduced than it used to be. And it's mostly because of this guy. Because the easiest, simplest way to get clean water to these villages is in the form of a bottle. You don't have to build a really much infrastructure. It's just kind of a plastic bottle. In fact, Copan Dry was able to come back because Copan Dry now has plastic bottles. So Coca-Cola, break all the ones that you want. You know, it's not worth anything. So you're not doing any damage to the capital structure of your competitor when you break their bottles. And when you start looking at plastic bottles and you start looking at how much bottled water consumption, it's growing everywhere. There's not a part of the world where we're not increasingly using more plastic water bottles. When you look at what the projections are, look at these rosy, shiny ones that you get from, you know, people who are doing research for the bottling industry. When you start looking at what percentage of packages are now transferred to plastic, you're seeing an incredible growth of it. I probably should have dropped this in. I just saw on LinkedIn yesterday, it was the top 10 packaging awards for the top 10 that were out there. One of them was a plastic pouch made to look like a glass jar, right? And out of the entire article of everything that's in there for our award winners, only, I think, two of them were recyclable, but there was no discussion about them. So we're still celebrating all this. But this is what it looks like in the waters of Honduras. So, you know, we're solving a problem, and that's good. And I think, you know, for every infant that you save because you brought clean water, it's hard to argue with that water bottle, right? We can't really, you know, easily villainize the plastic water bottle. But we have solved that problem in a vacuum without really understanding the context in which solutions need to be solved, without taking a comprehensive, integrated approach to design or to the things that we make, we do this. You probably saw this movie in Bali, right? This is someone scuba diving. It's just unbelievable. It just goes on for minutes and minutes and minutes. I'll be in Bali in a couple of weeks, and it's just frightening to sort of see that gradual decline and what's going on there. So whether it's on the top of the water, it's in the water, it's on our beaches, we're talking about a tremendous amount of material, 8 million tons. And every 8 million tons every year we're dumping in to our oceans. And every ocean, every country is to blame. There's really nowhere that like you can really say it's not happening. Every ocean is having these issues. It's our problem, not a problem somewhere else. What's interesting is when you really start trying to understand like what is the cause? What are all these plastics that we're seeing? What is that stuff? The only way to solve that problem is to really start digging into the details. And some of the things are kind of frightening. So some of the data that we have recently has been done in Australia. So the amount of tire dust is one of those things that no one really saw coming. But think about it, right? We're replacing our tires every, you know, few thousand kilometers, right? Well, where did all that tire go? You know? And it's a great, you know, a rubber tire is a great solution in a vacuum to what the kinds of things that we're trying to do. But contextually, is that a great solution? But it's amazing, you know, and synthetic fibers, certainly the microplastics and the polyester shirts that we're wearing, a lot of that stuff is kind of going through our washing machines, then going through water filtration systems designed 20 or 30 years ago, where they didn't think about having to capture that. And there's no real capital structure to change our water filtration systems to be able to capture it now without massive investment. So our, you know, we're a little bit out of phase in terms of the way we're treating to what we're putting into our water. And it's not great what's going on there. So depending on, there's a variety of different scales of ocean plastic that are out there. So, you know, on the larger scale, we start thinking about entanglement, you know, and real physical barriers. But then you can get into small pieces of plastic, which is what a lot of birds kind of perceive as something that might be tasty. You get into the smaller stuff that shrimp, and then you get into the krill that are actually digesting the microplastics, and now it's coming nanoplastic. I was in Marimbula today, and you see those wonderful oyster beds everywhere. The amount of nanoplastic that nanoplastic particles that our oysters are processing is still under study, but in some cases, millions of particles per hour. So as the ocean, you know, as the plastic starts to break down and it goes through these systems, it's getting smaller and smaller. And our oysters are the filters of our oceans, right? They're the ones, they're the last ones to see it. Only 6% of all plastic floats. So 94% of it is going down there. So when we hear about these big islands of plastic, these gyres and things that we're trying to address, it's literally like the tip of the plastic berg, right? It's only that 6%. Imagine 94% below that. That's what we're doing. And it's all starting on land, right? 80% of it is directly attributable to land activity. So, you know, tens of thousands of islands in the archipelago, if you go to the Philippines, Indonesia, throughout Malaysia and all that, most of those islands don't have a waste management strategy in place at all. There's really no plan for where that stuff to go. So we really have to be mindful that we're starting off with this stuff there. So there are people who are collecting. And so through at least my work helping to co-found OceanWorks, which is a company working on help trying to clean up the mess, and I'm working with a lot of other companies as well now to try to see it more comprehensively than just an ocean plastic issue, we start to realize that there are a lot of people trying to do work. In Phuket, before you do your kickboxing, you know, on the beach, the first thing to do is to go help everyone. Everyone goes and helps and picks up the ocean plastic that's washed up onto the beach so that they can do their kickboxing practices on the beach. So you have that some of that stuff that's that coastal plastic, and that's the stuff that we usually think of. But again, 80% of it's starting on land. So most of it's starting off as something that you, if you're in Haiti or if you're in somewhere on Java or wherever, that it started off as something that you were drinking from. It went somewhere. You're not really sure. It went away, right? Like all those bottles are going away. We put them in a bin. It's away. Where is away? We're still living in away, aren't we? Right? And so where does that go? And a lot of that stuff is then, you know, getting into an ocean stream by going through a waterway after it rains enough, goes into rivers. A lot of times it gets blown into like near shore. It might wash back up to the beach, or if it floats, it'll make it out to one of those gyres. So each one of these places, there's scuba divers that do cleanups. There's people doing beach cleanups. There's people trying to, you know, unbelievably try to clean up stuff in the high seas. There are a lot of efforts. And what we've realized is that each one of those efforts really needs a little bit of coordination and connection. But it is possible to start kind of diagramming and organizing this behavior. There's some good benefits to then picking up that plastic. For instance, if I take 1 kilogram of ocean plastic and I use that instead of virgin plastic, I can save another 5 kilograms of CO2. So in addition to being able to, you know, clean up something and prevent the suffering of a bunch of animals that might be ingesting that, I can also be having an impact on the carbon footprint. So part of the work is just trying to figure out, what do we have? And this is not really intended, right? It's kind of like picking up after people. In fact, most of the work that I've done, I've tried to explain my work in ocean plastic as addressing a runny nose, you know? I mean, when you get sick, there's something causing the sickness, or when I had Mr. Amoeba in me, I won't go into those symptoms, but when you have something, there is a sign of sickness. And to me, ocean plastic is simply a sign of sickness. The places that I go, whether it's a medical waste facility in Sri Lanka or anywhere else, there is a lot more than ocean plastic to be worried about. There's child trafficking, there's sexual injustice, there's transient labor, there's indigenous rights being trampled, there's, I mean, you name it, it's there. But then there's always ocean plastic there too, is what I've found. So if ocean plastic can become the wedge or the clue or the symptom, or, you know, I can be the tissue to go after that, also lets me understand that there is some sickness in that area that we can all identify and go after. So we have to understand, what is it? You know, what exactly is the symptom about? And so part of it is thinking about, what are the materials? So fishing nets, it's amazing, you know, how much fishing nets are, you know, are abandoned. And most fishermen will have to take that fishing net and pay for it to be disposed of when they come back to port. Well, it would be a lot easier after about a 3-year service life, when they started having too many holes to mend, just to cut it loose, right? And that's really what's happening, because there's a penalty for actually bringing it back. So through some great work, there's a group called Plastics in Denmark, which is organizing the Global Ghost Gear Initiative to be able to recycle those. There's about 100 ports now that will actually pay fishermen for those nets. What a huge impact. You can bring in so much material if you actually value that material. And at the end of the day, if we're going to have to be like answering to a capitalist type of approach to everything like that, then we just have to assign a value to it, don't we? And until we value it, we don't pick it up. So, well, that's what we've started to see, is that why don't we stop thinking about this as waste material, and in the words of William McDonough, just think of it as technical nutrient. This is nutrient that we can use. This is things that can go become something else. We have to eliminate the concept of waste. There is no such thing as waste, because there is no away. Unless all of you know of a planet I can go to beyond this one. So we've been looking at, you know, trying to then understand, what are the characteristics of each of these material? How much, you know, can we dive into this and really get a handle on it? What exactly is the nature of these materials? Why does this one flow? This one's waxy, this one's not, this one's strong. And then through that, then start to organize something so we can actually kind of at least get it back into a useful life. Now, I'll be the first person to say that single-use plastic just needs to be eliminated, period. Can I get an amen, Southern way? Okay, thank you. A little Southerner came out of me there. However, the nose is still running, right? We gotta clean our face, okay? So the whole idea here is, if we're gonna clean up, we gotta give some value, so at least we gotta have a place for this stuff to go, and hopefully into a circular economy, some place where it can exist. So what we're doing is working with people who are collectors, trying to talk recyclers into taking ocean plastic instead of the post-consumer all the time, talking to manufacturers saying, it's gonna be okay, we cleaned it really nice, we're not gonna screw up your $1 million machine, which is a valid concern for any foreman, right? Like, they don't want their machines breaking. And then talking to people who are gonna assemble and work with these materials and work through a new supply chain they've never heard of before, talking to brands about how they talk to the public about ocean plastic, and that we're trying to take all the risk out of it. Each one of these people, it's a difficult, long set of conversations. until there's alignment societally that this is something we have to do, that we have to address, it makes it tough. So I've just been gabbing a lot lately. So this is kind of the way we started diagramming it then, is like, how do we pull it out of the ocean? How do we pull it out of these waste streams and start turning it into a circular economy? How do we work with designers who don't think just about where stuff is coming from, but where it's going? I mean, I keep coming back to the leaf. Like, what an amazing invention the leaf is, right? I mean, who would say that you can grow a solar panel, right? And then, like, during the whole time it's useful, when there's a whole lot of sun, that it can just completely, you know, go straight into these chemical reactions, creating sugars to feed a whole nutrient. Oh, and when you don't need it, it becomes this wonderful compost that helps all these other living things in the soil. What an amazing design that is, right? That's a true circular design. How are we not thinking that way yet? Like, where else do we need to go? What other clues do we need in front of us to be able to do it? So circular economy is where it's at. We got to be thinking not just where things come from, but where are they going? Design for disassembly. Design for reuse. We actually have to think about designing to the next level. It's the higher order of things that we make. So in some cases, we've been able to do some things. So I think my partner originally had kind of, had been thinking about ocean plastic, sitting on the beach watching all this plastic and then watching everyone walking around in sunglasses going, okay, let's just connect those two dots. Let's take that ocean plastic and turn it into sunglasses. Kelly Slater then got really excited, said, okay, well, what else can you do with them? What can I use in my apparel? We said, okay, well, why don't we just turn some ocean plastic and at least in some buttons for your apparel. Instead of using all the virgin materials, can you start doing that? And they've been doing a great job for us. I think we just lost something. Oh. And then most recently, I was in Sri Lanka, and we got really excited. It was great to be, it's just so inspiring that Team Sri Lanka and the cricket team has been wearing ocean plastic harvested from the shores of Sri Lanka, right? They actually harvested, purified, recycled, cut and sewed the garments, and then had their own World Cup team wearing that stuff. What an awesome thing they've done. Next World Cup, Australia, right? You can do anything of it. I mean, a lot of the ball caps that we're wearing, actually, if you just look at them, it's the same materials we're finding in ocean plastic. If I look at even, like, you know, the fanciest ski jacket out there and the hanger that it comes on, all that stuff are the same materials that I'm finding in the ocean. It's really not that difficult to comprehend. If I can figure that out, there's a lot, all those people who are in those supply chains who can figure it out. And we've been working with some of them. Most of the footwear you're wearing has a bunch of synthetic materials into it. Again, I want to get rid of that stuff as much as we can, but while we're still using and still designing with those things, can we at least use some of the ocean plastic stuff? All the cones, highway barricades, things that I see in coastal towns, can that not be stuff that we clean up from our own oceans, from our own shores? Can we not use that stuff? The U.S., like Australia, has a little bit of a reckoning to do, which is a lot of our plastic is being sent elsewhere. And it was just kind of interesting to hear about, like, you know, reading these reports about especially, like, the ASEAN area, you know, whether it's Malaysia, Indonesia, they're, you know, the worst polluters in ocean plastic. But then to realize that's where America and Australia is sending all their plastic. And then we send our researchers to study how bad of a problem they have, right? But that is changing, and they're not accepting those plastics. There is a reckoning here. People aren't going to take our garbage. The away is coming closer to here than ever, in more ways than one. But that's an opportunity. On the left there is a recycling plant. On the right is a mining plant. The equipment, the engineers, the calculation, the basic processes, almost all of it is so similar. It's unbelievable. You see the same mining companies making, I mean, the logos on the lifts, on the conveyor systems, on all that stuff is almost the same. And I know Australia, like everyone else, is having issues with, like, what happens to these industries that we've been depending on, and where do those jobs go? What do we do with that workforce? Well, you know, there's something knocking on the door right there. Is there a way we can take our mining industry and transition it not to just below ground mining, but maybe underwater mining, or at least mining the stuff that's in our bins in our municipal systems instead of sending it somewhere else. It's a way that we can actually put our own people to work. It's a way to take advantage of our own stuff. I mean, in Sri Lanka, what they started to realize is all that plastic that's washing up onto their shores, a lot of it's actually coming from India. When I'm looking at bottles there, I'm reading them in Arabic. I mean, ocean plastic is connecting us all, right? I mean, it's becoming like our blood. Well, let's at least start working with it. Let's put it to work. Let's make it useful. There's a potential there. There's a potential for jobs. There's a potential for clean air environment while we employ people. And I know in North Carolina, we just had this devastating thing of just losing all our textile industry. And as I watch these amazing pattern makers and people who are just unbelievable with machine mechanics and all that stuff, and as they retire out, the young people who are now trying to get the industry back have no connection to that expertise. How tragic is it to lose the embedded knowledge of a community? You have all this brain power and so many of these things that can apply. Is there a way that we can actually take this on? Is there a way we can own this and say, this is us, this is our time, this is the way we're going to do it? Even if the plastic isn't from here, we want to do it, we want to take charge of it. Maybe there's a way to do that. And I think that's what the future is going to be. And I am like listening to young people about oomph. To hear that oomph is like, well, here's a chance for that oomph, right? Here's a chance for us to own this. I mean, it's threatening our oysters right here. Right? And we're also being threatened with job loss from antiquated industries. Is there a way we can kind of connect this and take this on as a serious thing? And it's not just going to be Australia. It's going to have to be the whole world. And we're seeing a lot of people do that. But we have to be brave enough. We have to be brave enough, as brave as our activist, right, to help, you know, try to, you know, stop action. But not just stop action, but take new action. I think it's there for us. I think it's in front of us. I think we have it. And we do that, we can have some unintended consequences. Thank you. People with